Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for the week of April 29th, 2024. I'm executive producer Jeff Proctor. We had a packed show last week, and I want to use the pod to highlight two segments. We'll start with the roundtable discussion I had with Source New Mexico editor Sean Griswold and freelance reporter Justin Horwath. They're both old friends, and I was eager to chat with them about a piece Justin wrote for New Mexico In Depth under the headline, Progressives Going After Incumbents in Hot Democratic Primaries. Provocative. Anyway, Sean, Justin, and I dove into the ideological split emerging in the New Mexico Democratic Party, how the outcomes of some of these primary races will impact the people who live in this state, and where the money's coming from to fund these campaigns. My favorite part of the conversation came at the end, when the three of us explored how news organizations should report on politics in New Mexico in 2024, what with Democrats strengthening their stranglehold on government here and all. Here's that roundtable discussion. Sean, welcome back to New Mexico in Focus. Justin, I can't believe I've had this job for 14 months, and this is the first time I've had you on the show. Thanks very much to both of you for coming today. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about the potential for a leftward shift in the New Mexico Democratic Party, what that means policy-wise for the people who live in this state, and also a little bit about journalism. How should we be covering the business of elected officials and what is increasingly becoming a one-party state? Let's start with the politics, and let's use Justin's recent story for New Mexico In Depth as the frame. I'm going to read a little bit from the top of the piece, starting with the headline, which I'd like to note did not lack spice. Progressives going after incumbents in hot Democratic primaries. Okay, then. Justin reports that Democrats are extremely likely to keep their huge majorities in both chambers of the legislature, but there's a fight brewing during primary season between progressives and moderate incumbents. And here's the money shot from Justin's story. Quote, because of this one-party dominance, the ideological fault lines within the Democratic Party have major policy implications on abortion, the environment, education, and workplace issues like minimum wage and paid family and medical leave benefits. Justin, let's start with you. What are the real stakes of this election for people who live in New Mexico? How will people feel it in their lives if the progressives pick up some seats?
I think it's all the policies that you listed off. The split within the Democratic Party is interesting because it is a difference over policies. And a lot of times you see intra-party battles where it might be a little bit of personality involved. And here, you know, there is a huge split within kind of the progressive organizing community that, you know, they're demanding paid family and medical leave, environmental protections, and, you know, any kind of those policies. And I think that a lot of this is just a big policy dispute within the Democratic Party.
Interesting. Sean, let's kick it to you, but kind of in the inverse. If the moderates hold some of these seats and the balance within the party sort of remains in the legislature, how will people who live here feel that in their everyday lives? What will be different for them?
Yeah, some of it might actually be very much the same. And I think that when we talk about the primary or the election, I think we have to look at the primary, which is going to be next week, first week of May. Early voting begins in New Mexico. So when we're talking about the election, we're talking about this. General election in November, a lot of these races we're seeing either in the state house or in the state senate, and as Justin's reporting is pointing towards, are going to be settled ahead of November. So right now, this is probably the most important time for local New Mexican voters to have a voice in the legislature in how their state government's going to work, because as you all both mentioned, as Justin's reporting points to, Democrats are going to maintain their majority in the Senate and the House. They're going to have another year with Michelle Lujan Grisham. So it's going to be a Democratic run at the roundhouse. So what's going to be most impactful for voters is, one, you're going to continue to see some of the similar policies and legislative stuff that we've seen over the past several years, where Democrats present a list of proposals and agendas. Several of them will make it through into laws. Republicans will kind of put up a little fight here and there, spend 3-4 hours filibustering, but then the Democrats will squash any opposition and pass it through to the governor. Within that, we're going to see a bit of a divide in the almost splitting hairs of the policy, where now we start to see the differences between how do you define a Democrat and what are Democratic policies? Because the Democrats in New Mexico run on multiple viewpoints. There's not a binary, like we're all marching order towards one viewpoint and goal. Sure, we all want to help New Mexicans and protect everybody, but And I think what Justin's reporting really shows us in the politics of it all is what those hairs are going to be split and defining what is a progressive Democrat, what is a centrist Democrat, what's a New Mexican Democrat. So I think for the majority of it, we're going to see kind of how that is defined in New Mexico, and that's what New Mexico is going to play a role in.
And like, does it settle at some point is another question for me. But I want to move on to this, and I want to let you both kind of take a whack at this. As Justin reported, there have been progressive insurgencies in New Mexico for a long time. But what I'm interested in is what is driving it this time around. Do residents, do voters, do people who live here want the party to move left? Or is what we're seeing two different ideologies among elites arguing for like what the soul of the party should be? What's pushing this insurgency this time? We'll start with you, Justin.
I think after AOC was elected in, I think it was 2016, and she had upset somebody who'd been in Congress and had a lot of power for a long time, and her campaign served as a lot of inspiration for the progressive organizing community. You know, I think that they are really getting their infrastructure together. You know, as we reported, they kind of moved their money between PACs and different nonprofits and various groups. And, you know, part of what they're doing is just getting people out in the streets and getting people advocating for their candidate, you know, whoever that may be.
Sean, what are you guys seeing at Source along those lines? What does it feel like this is an actual kind of grassroots thing that's asking the party to change or adopt kind of different philosophies? Or is this more of a top-down kind of thing?
It is a power structure. I mean, it's a little bit of both, but it's a power structure. Right now, the progressive Democrats run one of the most powerful positions in New Mexico's House of Representatives, Javier Martinez from Albuquerque. And that progressive policies include, you know, legalization of cannabis, regulations and enhancement to promote reproductive health services in the state, you know, enhancing protections for workers, but also creating environmental protections on oil and gas industries. And that's where we begin to see a split. And this is what Justin's reporting really starts to show. Because Justin does the research and shows us, and we can talk, obviously we're talking about this later.
We'll get to the money in a second.
But the points that he hits on, it shows that the interests that come to who's giving money to which lawmakers or which candidates tells us where those splits we're seeing. And some of them do happen with oil and gas regulations and environmental concerns. So now we're seeing a bit of like progressive ideology is focused, and the progressive wing, as we're discussing here, does have identity in focusing on how do you regulate the environment, how do you regulate environmental protections, excuse me, how do you regulate and provide you know, services that the oil and gas industry will can continue to keep it sort of boom, how are you going to protect the environment and ensure New Mexicans are safe from it. And I think that's where we're noticing a split. Justin's reporting shows that clearly, too.
Yeah, and let's talk about the money for a second. First of all, I just want to say it's good to have you back reporting on New Mexico politics. Yeah. And in this story, in classic Horwath fashion and New Mexico in-depth fashion, you focused on the money. And I don't want to get into the individual corporations necessarily, but give viewers a sense, if you could, of like who is funding these kind of two different philosophies and ideologies you wrote about.
If you're an incumbent in New Mexico, you're going to get corporate money, you know, almost regardless of what your policy positions are. You know, you get an office and that's the corporations are courting you. And these are some of the biggest corporations in the nation, in the world. You know, they're Fortune 500 companies. And on, you know, the challengers, the people who are challenging the incumbents, they don't have any corporate money, really. You know, they're getting their money from individual contributions is a big part of it, but also, and again, you know, the progressives have always had this infrastructure of nonprofits, issues-based nonprofits. You know, they could be in California, they could be in New Mexico, they could be anywhere, but they, you know, they'll send money to these little tiny legislative races in New Mexico to affect policy.
Sean, what should voters make of where the money comes from along the sort of axis that Justin was just describing? Should it matter when you go and pull the lever in the ballot box, like whether it was Chevron or an individual contributor who funded the candidate?
You know, for a voter, I think it's important to, at least the voters tell me, and as a voter myself, I can say that I am interested in understanding what are those interests the money is paying for? What is the influence that they're providing, that they're, the access they're given? Are they having an influence on legislation, on laws that impact my everyday life? That's what I care most about, because I do know, obviously, money in politics is coming from everywhere. And if those interests, whether they lie, originated in Bareilles in Albuquerque, or they're from a place in California, New York, Texas, another state, because we see this on both factions of the parties here in New Mexico, both Republican and Democrat have outside interests. Beyond the business interest, which exists in New Mexico outside of its government, it really does depend on the philosophical ideas of, is that interest serving my life as a New Mexican? And what are my values for that? So that's why I think the environment is a continued split, because that is one of the true core values of what it is to be a New Mexican is, you know, beautiful blue sky, the sunset, the mountains. And that's where at the core of it, we're also seeing that philosophical divide beyond just the politics here.
Yeah, and I'm glad we've teased that out a little bit, that where you really see the split is on environment issues and the way funding works for those. So I left some time at the end of this for the part of the conversation I'm most excited about. So lest the three of us come in for the proverbial lashing on Elon Musk's hell site for only talking about Democrats, I want to acknowledge that there is, of course, a big old fight happening on the Republican side for the soul of that party as well. That's obviously between the MAGA Trumpers and the Never Trumpers. But that's a conversation for another day. And as we've been talking about, the reality in New Mexico is that the action is on the Dem side. So my question is, how do we deal with that reality as journalists? Sean, you and I have been talking about this kind of a lot lately. How do we avoid things like false equivalence? How do we avoid making one thing look bigger so that it equals something else? How do we be honest with our audiences but not partisan when it comes to covering what's increasingly becoming a one-party state?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, working with actual truths, the foundation of what those are and establishing what those are, we have to do that. That's just the bare minimum, in fact, that we have to set now as journalists, and has become an expectation with the climate of the sort of fake news that we've survived through and we're working to continue to fight. I will say that within that, you know, you mentioned the sort of MAGA identity of Republican politics in New Mexico. That coalition is strongly supported by a more grassroots effort of New Mexicans who are giving micro donations of $10, $15, $26 that are similar to what you're seeing with the progressive coalitions and soliciting funds from just individual people who are not corporate interests, who just want to give money to a candidate. Yep. And that's what's building that coalition too. So it's interesting to see it on both ends play out. But one of the things that I would also say, that I would say within that, within once we establish those truths, now we have to hold, you know, powerful accountable. And in New Mexico, that is the progressive politics. That is the progressive policies. That is the Democratic Party. Every single one of our elected officials in the congressional delegation is a member of the Democratic Party. The governor, the entire legislature, all the way down to local levels now. There are some pockets, of course, of Republican-run local places. And that does give us a little insight into some of their policies. Again, back to the environment, oil, places like San Juan County, Curry County, Otero County, you know, heavy oil and gas stuff and heavy Republican spaces. But to me, and I'm curious about how you approach it from there, once we've identified, okay, who's in charge, how do you then now use what you did in your research for looking into campaign filings? How does that help you identify sort of what the policies are from that point?
Yeah, I mean, in political reporting, one mantra of mine has always been policy over polls. You know, there is a place for, you know, so-called horse race reporting. People need to know who's ahead, and that is news, you know. But at the same time, I think that we really do, as journalists, need to focus on policy, because we're, you know, writing for our readers and our listeners, our audience, and those are the people affected by policies. And I think that, you know, as a journalist, you really got to stick up for your readers and for your audience and fight for them and fight for, you know, transparency around policy.
In New Mexico, right, the policy is coming from the Democrats. And sort of part of what I'm getting at here is, like, I feel like during the session, I read too many stories early in the session about a proposal to bring back the death penalty. That's not going to happen. And my concern is, when readers see something like that, that is set down right next to, like, the paid family and medical leave thing. Mm-hmm. Like, these are two competing proposals that might happen during the course of a legislative session. So that death penalty bill was dead on arrival, not going anywhere, not going to happen. So as journalists, like, I get that someone has proposed this, but what do we do with that?
Yeah, I think we have to understand it from the historical context and lay out, again, the foundation to readers at the very beginning. Hey, this got proposed. This is likely where it's going to go, and it will ultimately seek a fate that it will not pass. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that effort's going to completely die. Who knows if that coalition of MAGA Republicans builds up actual support and leadership and then enacts their own policies 10, 15 years down the line. The progressive Democratic power wing we're seeing took generations to build. And so I think it's important for us, that's why we need local journalists here. I'm happy you're here again. I praise to that, because we need to establish our time in being here so we can follow those trends. You know, what we're seeing within the issue of the legislature of power happening between the Democratic Party is something that we've reported on in the past, right? Like you mentioned earlier, John Arthur Smith. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's now like, okay, let's go back to that time. I wasn't here for that. Were you here when that element happened? Because that kind of is the moment a lot of people will point to, and it was recent, that kind of led us to where we are now when it comes to this divide of the Democratic fighting in the roundhouse.
Yeah, it was definitely a previous effort at this, and I am terribly sorry to do this, that this went by way too fast, as I knew it would, but thanks a ton to both of you fellas for coming in. Yeah. I really appreciate Justin and Sean for chewing on these questions with me. And I know I said it during the segment you just listened to, but I want to point out again how glad I am to have Justin back reporting on politics in New Mexico. Justin and I are former colleagues, and he is an outstanding reporter. He took a break from this beat for a few years, but we should all be glad he's back in the mix. Now, changing gears. I think most listeners of this podcast will be familiar with New Mexico Voices for Children, the nonprofit organization that has been helping low-income children and families and working to end child poverty in our state for decades. The organization has a new executive director, Gabrielle Ubaez, a product of Albuquerque's South Valley, who has stepped into this role at yet another inflection point for the future of child well-being in New Mexico. She sat down with correspondent Russell Contreras for a chat on just her 12th day in the new role. Here's that conversation.
Gabrielle Ubaez, thank you for joining us here at New Mexico in Focus.
Thank you for having me, Russell.
So, New Mexico Voices for Children, they have this annual kids count report. It monitors our child poverty annually. While there are some positive signs about improving families with, say, high school diplomas, we still rank near the bottom in many categories. What are we getting wrong here?
Thank you for that question, Russell. I think that the kids count report doesn't tell us a full story, and it tells us a very important part of the story at the same time. So our most recent kids count data showed that 24% of children in New Mexico are still living in poverty, and that's down from 31% 10 years ago. So we're making great strides, and what we measure matters. At Voices, we like to nerd out about policy and the way that we look at data, and there are other ways to look at where New Mexico is in terms of poverty for children. One of those ways is the supplemental poverty measure, and when we look at that, we're actually at 10%, and that's because of the really robust income support programs that our state has enacted recently.
Income support programs, nerding out, love this, but we often hear critics of reports like these say, oh, let's not compare New Mexico to other states. Let's just dismiss the data. What are the dangers when we say that? Let's just dismiss the data. New Mexico is so unique. We don't need to compare ourselves to Connecticut or Massachusetts. Are there any dangers in that?
I don't think there are dangers in that specifically, and I don't see the value in saying, okay, we're 50th. I think we need to look at the individual data sets and understand sort of what policies and systems are resulting in those outcomes and look at them both in discrete ways but in interconnected ways. And so we need to understand that we're competing against ourselves, and there are other things we can measure that show us where we're making positive impact.
We often ask the educational system to fix everything when we're not dealing with poverty. What should we be doing to address the poverty and child well-being when that could fix the educational system? See, it's the other way around. Is there anything we need to be thinking about holistically there?
Yeah, the persistent childhood poverty narrative in New Mexico is something I'm really interested in. And I think, you know, there's a few issues with that narrative that we need to address. Is we need to talk about it with a lot more nuance, and understand how poverty impacts different families in different ways because of historic inequities and oppression that is like baked into our systems. And so we know that children of color suffer much greater rates of poverty. I think Hispanic children are at 27%. Black children in New Mexico, 29%, Native children, 39%. And so we need to understand how race plays into inequities that result in poverty. At the same time, you know, in New Mexico, our goal should be zero children living in poverty, and 14% of white children also are living in poverty in New Mexico. The other thing I'd like to say is when we look at the deficit-based data, some people are very rightfully frustrated and think that we're saying New Mexico is bad or New Mexicans are bad. Absolutely not. We believe that systems that have existed for a really long time are resulting in these persistent poverty rates. And the good news is we have the power to change them. And so what I'm really proud of is especially in the last decade, New Mexico has made great strides in those income support programs that I talked about that has reduced our supplemental poverty rate to 10%. So New Mexico families are doing much better, and we have results to show for it, and so we should keep investing in those programs.
You make a good point. Let's look at some other data rather than the data that we run to, say, like the lunch programs and so forth. What other data should we be pulling out and looking at that tells us a different story that would kind of change the way we look at things? Is there anything you can point to say we should be focusing on that?
I don't know exactly like what other data we should be looking at in terms of people, but what I will say is we should also start collecting data that focuses on systems. And so not how are New Mexicans doing as the only thing we look at, but how are systems serving people? How are they reaching people? And how are those systems impacting their lives? So let's judge the systems a little more and compare that to where people are ending up as a result of them.
So that you wouldn't put the blame on the people, you're saying, wait a minute, you have to consider the systems.
Yeah, we never put the blame on the people. It's the systems that we have the power to change. And that's the good news, right? We create the systems, we can reimagine them too.
That's a good point, but how can we measure those systems? Because we could go a lot of different. You can measure the school districts, measure agencies. What could we do to measure some of those?
Yeah, I mean, so New Mexico Voices for Children has this reputation as a tax and budget policy organization, which I really love. It's very nerdy, and it's maybe something that people don't immediately care or think about when they think about improving New Mexico. But that's a big one, right? Addressing wealth inequality and who pays into the system and how is a big part of what we should measure. And New Mexico is doing really great there. I don't know if you've heard this stat, but we're in the top 10 in the nation for the most fair and progressive tax policies, and we actually are the most improved in the nation. And so those who are making and earning the least are not paying the most anymore, and those who are very well off and wealthy are paying more into the systems that benefit us all. And so that's one example of where we can measure our systems for impact.
Since the 1960s, efforts to fight inequality is centered around anti-poverty initiatives. But there's a new movement talking about, let's start talking about building wealth, financial literacy. Where do you come out on that?
So that's my jam. My background is in wealth building. I want to be very clear that I don't think the discussion should ever be, should we focus on poverty alleviation or wealth building? It's and. We need them both. Wealth building, the difference is that it's not just about meeting people's immediate needs so they can survive, but it's about giving them the infrastructure and dignity to make their own decisions. What that looks like in policy are things like baby bonds, access to affordable credit, free college tuition, access to affordable childcare, and things that allow people to build financial stability and advance their lives on their own terms with support from our state government. And so this is not bootstraps, right? This is how do we use state government to give people dignity in making their own financial decisions that improve their lives.
Now, you're from the South Valley. You're a product of the South Valley, and yet you went to college out of state.
Yeah.
What are we missing to give other South Valley young women like yourself the same resources to think about higher education in other states, because more folks say, you got lucky, you get into a program, right? The world was helped you out some ways. But that's not how it works. How could we talk to some of those other South Valley girls today and say, no, you can follow in Gabrielle's footsteps and go to school in California, or think about Yale. What are we doing?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I will proudly claim the South Valley. My parents are from Rio Grande High School. I actually went to Valley High School, so I was a North Valley kid. But Valley girl through and through, similar experience, you know, going to an Albuquerque public school. And I think dreaming bigger than maybe some of the people around me thought was possible. Part of it was luck, but not dumb luck. It was the adults around me creating things that set me up for success. A big thing in my life was an after-school and summer program I went to called Working Classroom. It's an organization that's still around. It's been around for, I think, almost 40 years now. And it's where we spent our summers and afternoons being critical thinkers. As 17, we were talking about things like predatory lending, which is hilarious to me, like what 17-year-old knows that term? And that just really got us involved in the community through arts and social justice and collaboration.
You have three small children, as I do. I have two. And you choose to live here in New Mexico, in Albuquerque. And you can go anywhere else, but why do you stay here?
This is home. I mean, we love New Mexico. We love the people here. And I know that both my husband and I really feel like we owe our hearts and our labor and our vision and our willingness to collaborate with others to make New Mexico the best place to be a kid, because it's the best place to be a teacher, a doctor, a care worker. That's how we get to make New Mexico the best place to be a kid.
Gabrielle Baez, Executive Director of New Mexico Voices for Children, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Russell.
We appreciate Gabrielle Baez for talking about her new job, why she took it on, and why she's hopeful about progress in an area that has plagued New Mexico for many years. Thanks for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow along with us on our social media pages during the week. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. I'm going to toss in another plug this week for our reworked website. That's newmexicopbs.org/productions/New Mexico in Focus. We've streamlined things and made them easier to find, including the podcast. Among other treats, you can read the New Mexico in-depth piece from Justin Horwath that sparked our conversation at the roundtable for last week's show. Thanks again, everyone. I'm executive producer Jeff Proctor. For Monday, April 29th, 2024, this is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast.